Here is the agenda for today. Today on the agenda, Greg, you had mentioned that you'd want to talk about the test suite a bit. Let's push that to the beginning of the agenda. And then the rest of the agenda are fairly new issues that Marcus has raised as he's been going through and editing the specification. Marcus has really been kicking ass on the specification and getting all of these issues resolved. So thank you for doing that, Marcus. It's a huge, huge help to see these issues evaporate in front of us, thanks to your hard work.
Something else I want to be sure we discuss is pervasive renaming of B nodes during expansion.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Should we push? Let's put that at the beginning of the agenda too. Because that can be a complicated problem. Hopefully it's not in this case, but okay. Anything else that we should add to the agenda? Today on the agenda we have issue 203, 204, 205, 206, and 109. They have to do with little things like validating IRIs and language tags, if we compact IDs relative to IRIs, use URL versus IRI, clarifying algorithms that operate on, clarifying that the algorithms operate on a copy and the input, so fairly straightforward things, and then adding a flatten method to the JSON-LD API. Anything else added to the agenda?
We should reiterate the schedule, I suppose, for future telecons.
Yeah, right. Okay, so we'll do that first. Okay, three items on the agenda. Additions to the agenda. Schedule for telecons and publication. The next two telecons are canceled because one of them falls on Christmas and the other one falls on New Year. We are still attempting to get a last call quality document ready for publication at the end of January. I think it's going to be doable for the JSON-LD syntax. It's going to be pretty tight for the API. And I think mostly it's because of editorial. You know, we just need to get all of these changes in and then get a review cycle done on the document before we can be sure of the last call stuff. We also want to make sure that when we go to last call, that we include text that gives us an easy out for stripping out features or changing the algorithms to match previous resolutions that we've had in this group. So, for example, if we find that there is an error in the JSON-LD, one of the API calls, typically it would be a non-editorial change if we change it in any significant way. But I think we want to put in some weasel wording in there that allows us to say, you know what, this is what we meant. We didn't necessarily, mean to. While we are changing the algorithm and it's a substantive change, the group agrees that this is what needs to happen in order for the right thing to happen in the algorithm. So we just need to make sure that we include language like that in both specifications. And then that protects us a bit from going through another last call. I would be surprised if we didn't have to go through two last calls with the document, just because I haven't really seen any spec of the W3C not go through two last calls for a version 1.0 spec. Okay, so we're basically shooting for a last call publication for both documents at the end of January. Hopefully the syntax document is pretty straightforward. The API document is going to be a little more difficult. Any comments on the schedule, telecons, or the publication schedule before we move on? All right. Next topic up is... Greg, which one would you prefer to do, the test suite or the other item?
I just briefly on the test suite. I think it's great. Marcus has been doing some expansion of that. There's a couple of things that we haven't accomplished in there yet, and that is, how to deal with sort of option or callback behavior for the things. Now, not everything that's a test is a test of a API. In some cases, they could be just algorithm tests. RDF is an example of that, for instance. But there's, for instance, in RDF, there's an option to either use native types or use RDF type. And we need to some way to be able to trigger those options. excuse me, we may also need to figure out a way to deal with other optional arguments. For instance, in Compact, you can pass an optional context to use for expansion. So I think that requires some discussion. But the thing that is more concerning is the granularity of tests. And the way that we've been doing them so far is it seems that each test basically tests some particular aspect of an algorithm, but often does that in many parallel ways, simultaneously, versus other test frameworks I've worked with where the tests are really small, basically the smallest test that could run that would exercise some particular facet of an algorithm. The advantage of the smallest possible tests is when something goes wrong, it's very easy to identify it. When you have other things that are more comprehensive, when something goes wrong, it becomes a major exercise just to ferret out what parts of a test are in error and how to reproduce that type of environment.
Right. So real quick on both of those points. Yeah, I absolutely agree with Greg that we should be writing tests that are the minimum possible thing to test one specific feature. We shot ourselves in the foot in the early days with the RDFA test suite by making the test too complicated. So, yeah, plus one to Greg on that. I'm saying that having no idea where the test suite is right now, how far off on that principle we are. The other thing for testing the API, we might actually want two separate test suites, one of them for testing the algorithms and the other one for testing the API, because the type of testing where you pass in different flags and you need to have different things happen as a result of that may be better tested with a testing framework like Mocha, which is an in-browser testing framework. So if we're doing, you know, a JavaScript API, the test suite that we write for that JavaScript API might be best tested in a JavaScript environment instead of us trying to figure out some way of divining whether or not certain flags were passed or how to set the flags. I feel like if we don't use the JavaScript framing, if we don't use the JavaScript, some kind of JavaScript test framework, we're going to end up coming up with some kind of meta language in the test suite to set certain flags on and off, and then implementers are going to have to read that meta language and figure out at which, you know, flags to turn on and off based on that. So, I guess what I'm suggesting is we do what Greg says, which is try and simplify the tests and break them out into more atomic tests. And for the API, we create a new testing framework instead of using the algorithmic one that we have right now. Greg, you're on the queue.
for RDFA, we did figure out a way to be able to add some other options. There's a couple of things that are done there. One is we can select host language and version, but also we have other processing flags that are passed along to a processor in the form of, there it's all done with URI calls, so it's done in the form of adding basically arguments to a URI, and we might be able to do something like that. The problem with a JavaScript-based testing framework is it's fine if you're testing JavaScript, but how do we then show equivalence across implementations that aren't, that don't run in the browser?
Marcus, you're on the queue. And Marcus, your audio, we can't hear you and haven't been able to hear you since the beginning of the call. I don't know if your audio is muted or there's some other issue with your audio. All right. So
can
while
you hear
we
me?
Wait, yeah, there we go.
Okay. Yeah, I was saying that I basically agree with Greg that we should try to define the test suite in a way that is independent of the target language. So I think it would be easy enough to have kind of a JSON file or JSON-LD file which includes the flags, just as we have the test manifests right now. And regarding the other point, I think we shouldn't eliminate all those complex tests. I mean, we should, of course, have the minimal tests, which test the basics, but sometimes, like, if there are IRI collisions or if you have to separate property generators in compaction again, for example, you have to test quite a lot of corner cases, and I don't think splitting them all up into different tests makes that much sense, because sometimes the parts work, but if you put them together, they break. So I think we should first have the simple tests, and then in the end have one kind of complex test with which combines everything more or less.
Yeah, I definitely feel that there's a role for complex tests, sort of more integration types of tests that might test multiple, the interaction of multiple features simultaneously. We might want to consider sort of segregating them in the number space so that you get through, there's space for all the simple things before you get to the complex things. And I think we also, if someone fails, it passes every simple test but fails a complex test, then I think we really need to make sure we create simple tests the simplest possible test that exercises the problems that come about. Otherwise, if the tests become a useful way to communicate the behavior of a system, it becomes sort of useless for that regard.
Yeah, that's so true. More or less, the complex test is just another test to ensure that everything is really correct, also in corner cases. But yeah.
I think we've used the notion, all the tests are numbered with 4 digits. Perhaps we should just put all the complex digits with a starting at 1,000.
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
Okay, so the proposal then is to move all of the, we're going to have unit tests, the requirement for unit tests are that you're just testing one feature of the language and only one feature of the language. And then integration tests start at number 1,000, and we'll just move anything that tests more than one feature to an integration test.
Yeah, I want to be clear, though, it's not simply one feature. Since you might have a test with many different things that are basically testing one feature, for instance, the way that IRI expansion happens when it's as part of a type in a context, as part of a ID in a context, as part of a term in a context, and all of the other things within the document itself. Those could all be considered to be one feature, but they are not the simplest possible test for those features. So I'd say that the axiom really should be the simplest, and there might be many of them for these various different things, but the simplest possible test to test a particular feature is the axiom.
Okay. Marcus, here, thank you.
Just a quick question. What are the requirements from W3C regarding the test suite? I mean, is it even required, or is it just desired, or?
It's not. It's What's required is an implementation report at the end that shows that there are two implementations that interoperate. That's the only requirement. But in order to make that easier for us to generate, usually some kind of automated test suite is the easiest way to do that. So the automated test suite would run all of the tests that we have against a particular implementation, and it would generate a report on that implementation as well. And then we would then take that information and generate the implementation report based on that. It's worked out really well for us in the RDFA group to have a test suite that we can just click a button and it runs all the tests. So we should probably try and do the same thing for this.
I'm not so sure. Automated test suites are challenging things to do, and they really require, in that case, an endpoint. I think what's much more common is to have developers use a test suite that they run. For instance, Sparkle and Turtle are this way. Do their own URL report, and then submit those URL reports, which then can be collated and do using a tool such as the one that I created that we used in RDFA and we're using for Turtle. So for my own testing infrastructure, it'd be very easy for me to generate an URL report after a test run, as long as it's done in a standard format, which, of course, in our case, probably would be some JSON-LD version of that. Not that I am averse to having some online test suite, but it was a complicated thing for RDFA, which is, I think, motivated partly because of the complex overlap of versions and host languages in RDFA and the explosion of the various document formats as a result of that.
My opinion is just slightly different in that it's nice to be able to have a test suite to go to where you can just select a processor and click run and see how well it's doing. Because otherwise you're dependent on the implementer to report it, and that's it's problematic. The report is not always up to date. Like what they think works is not always up to date. There might be a bug, and it's hard for people to kind of test to see if, it's a bug in that version of the implementation, or if, the library itself actually has an issue. I think the thing that resonates with me is that the test suite, having an automated test suite like that, is difficult to do. It's hard to put together. It takes time to put together. And I do think you're right. The RDFA test suite was really, I think we ended up rewriting it three times. Each time we were coming to a last call with those documents. So if we decide to do that, it's a time commitment, and it's not clear who's got the time to write such a thing.
The other thing with the RDFA test suite is it was intended that people run tests for themselves and submit URL reports. That really never happened. I ended up rerunning URL reports every time there was a change, which was really, really quite, it was a fair amount of work, frankly.
Right. And unfortunately, I think that's what we had to do for every iteration of the. It was really hard to get implementers to run the test suite and submit, the reporting stuff. We had to do it more in a pull way rather than them pushing the reports to us. Especially when it comes down to the wire and you're trying to get everything collated and the implementer's not responding. So that's the main reason, at least for me, for having that automated test suite online is so that we are not blocked by the implementers when it comes time to reporting whether or not implementations are passing or not. I'm trying to think of an easier way to actually build that report. Like I think we could do it all in. we've have some toolkits now that we didn't have when we built the RDFA, the test suite. That may make building it a little easier.
Building it's pretty easy, and we could certainly repurpose the RDFA test suite infrastructure for doing it. It's much simpler because we don't have a Sparkle element, of course.
Right.
So you know, we could do that. A variation of what we have.
Just right. I'm wondering if we could run it completely in the browser. Instead of running it, you know, having a server-side component to it. And if we can do that, it would make it massively simpler to write.
Yeah, the problem is it could be done if you did a call out to the service in order to return it. The fact that we're returning JSON may get over the you know, that problem that we would have had with RDFA. So.
So what I might do is I might take a crack at this at some point in the next 2 months to see what I can accomplish in like 2 or 3 days, and if we can get you know 70% of the way there, then that's good. And if we can't, we can just ask the implementers to produce Earl reports, right? I mean, that's always.
Well, we could always fall back to the way that it's done in RDFA by letting the server. Do those calls.
Right. I was speaking more to your concern that it would be fairly, you know, it might be complicated to write the service to put all this stuff together. I'm trying to find the low-hanging fruit, a way for us to generate the test suite.
And I think doing it in the browser would be great. If there's going to be a service required, I think, in any case. Think leveraging the RDFA version would be fairly easy, but there is some days of work to make that happen.
Right.
Anyway.
Okay. Well, how about this? I'll volunteer to take a first pass at it, and then we'll see where we are. And either I'm successful or I fail doing it, and then we can fall back to plan two, whatever that is. Okay. Okay, so I guess what we've discovered is we want to make the test suite far more atomic, testing the smallest possible feature or sub-feature. Those are all unit tests. We will have integration tests starting at number 1000 and going up from there. We are going to need some form of some mechanism, or we're going to attempt to create some kind of mechanism that's an online test suite that tests people's implementations. Anything else that we should be aware of for the test suite? Okay. So moving on to the next topic, which I forget. What was the other item we needed to discuss, Greg?
Renaming of the blank notes.
Right.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
So Marcus wrote a test that tests that when you expand using a property generator anyway, or perhaps not using a property generator, it renames all the blank nodes. And the reason for that, as I gather, is an observation that, well, actually backing a little further, the use of blank node generation and expansion is required for property generators for node definitions that do not contain an ID. So that when you duplicate that, you're basically not creating a new node. You're just creating a replication of the same node.
The problem then is
that if you pick an identifier base for blank node generation, what happens when you run it against a document which there's an overlap?
Mm-hmm.
So solution is to rename all the blank nodes If in my mind that's a pretty heavyweight thing to do, and it breaks current usage at Wikia, where we are unfortunately depending upon the stability of B-node identifiers. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we don't do that. But I think we need to discuss perhaps an alternative might be to detect an overlap in naming and trigger some event as a result of that.
So what you're proposing is that we create something like underscore colon JSON-LD rename or whatever, and then start pounding it at that point. And if we detect a B-node that's named that, then we create a new. What happens if you go through the algorithm twice? Meaning you create. Are you saying raise an error whenever you detect a previously used B-node identifier?
Well, that would be the easiest thing to do. An alternative would be to scan through, and after having scanned, you should be able to have, by gathering all the B-node identifiers in use, you can then pick a identifier to use that does not collide.
Yeah, the scan through thing is, we can't do any kind of stream-based processing at that point, but I don't know if we can do that now because of all of the features that we've added. So one of the use cases with streaming, if we require a scan through of the document, then streaming's out. Or you're saying that you need to hold the entire document in memory or pre-process the document and then process the document again.
I think, frankly, that's just the case for JSON.
Yeah. Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Could we state that a certain kind of B-node prefixes aren't allowed?
Well, then the issue is what happens if you actually use the property expansion algorithm once, and it generates those prefixes, and then you add some data or modify the document and run it through again, right? Which means that. So what we could do is create some kind of random, say that the random identifier has to be created, and then the chances of collision are fairly low, but that doesn't prevent that, and it's fairly non-deterministic when you do get a collision. Marcus, you're on the queue.
I mean, I'm not really understanding what's the problem we're trying to solve here, or what's the use case of referencing blank nodes externally, because all the document internal references, they don't break. It's just if you reference them externally. And, I mean, the fact that B nodes are just local identifiers means that we can safely change them whenever we want.
Well, except so Greg, I believe Greg is saying that there's a use case in Wikia where they depend on the B-node identifier not changing when it goes through the compact and expansion algorithm, which on the surface
seems
wrong. Yeah,
what I'm asking is, wouldn't it be simpler to change that behavior instead of changing the other algorithms?
Well, I mean, it just that we have, so far we have tried to keep the JSON form pretty consistent with what is written, and there may be other uses where I think people commonly create B-node, when they're creating B-node identifiers, do so using some internal logic, and it's true that as RDF, those really don't have meaning, and in fact, it's an error if you depend upon that across RDF serializations. This is just a big step when for the JSON algorithms, expansion and compaction, that has not been required before. It's required in flattening for sort of obvious reasons, but there we're doing a much larger type of transformation of the document. So it's not that I wouldn't vote against. If basically if that's the only way to do it, then I'd say that we should go ahead and do that renaming. But do we always rename, or is it only triggered when you you find property generators? You know, it's a big change. It seems a little bit late to be introducing that big a change to probably the most central algorithm, if there's some way to avoid it.
Would it be a problem to use column IRIs for your use case, for example, because they don't change and they are blank nodes effectively as well?
Well, I mean, we have deployed code at this point and data. Changing that, we're going to have to do that at some point, but I really don't want to do that until we've been able to replace our use of IDs, you know, BNode IDs with URIs, which is coming up probably in January. I don't want to get hung up on what Wiki is doing with it. I think that's sort of it's an anti-pattern to do it that way. But I just cite that as an example of something where previously, throughout expansion and compaction, there was a sort of a contract that we weren't messing with BNode identifiers. We're doing that now, and it might be what we have to do, but it is a really big change.
Well, why can't we, instead of redoing every single BNode identifier in the document, why can't we just track all of the BNode identifiers that have been seen in the document to this point, and then generate the ones that we generate? We have to generate new ones. We just check to see if the one that we generated matches something that we've previously done. I guess the problem with that is that you don't know if in the future there's going to be a BNode identifier.
Yeah.
You'd have to scan the document, look for things that match your BNode generator pattern, and then find the last one and start over again using the next, either the next point or pick, for instance, we're using T something or other, I think, pervasively now, although I don't know if we actually specify that. You'd have to start over, say, with U or something like that, or TT.
Right.
And that's not it's not an impossible thing to do, obviously.
Yeah. Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Yeah. We could track those and I mean, if we just use avoid a recommendation that if you need to preserve your BNode for debugging and then a pattern like the one we defined to be used for generating IDs. It can be based on a common prefix like gen ID and then the date time stamp in hex and something like that. And the
testing hard.
Yeah, well,
you can't look for document equivalents, which is what we do now.
Well, Greg, would it be a terrible thing if in the case that there is a collision that the BNode is renamed? Because so in most cases, there's not going to be a clash. In 99.99% of the cases, there's not going to be a clash between the BNode identifiers that the system's using and the BNode identifiers that the property expansion algorithm uses. But if there is a collision, then the BNode is going to be renamed, right?
Yeah, I know, but you might have a collision until you've already started generating. Basically, what you would need to do is keep track of those BNodes and then restart expansion with a new BNode identifier base if you detect a collision.
I don't believe that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the problem with keeping track of all the BNode identifiers you've generated is that you don't know what's coming down the pipeline. If we basically say that Yes, we don't know what's coming down the pipeline, and if there is an overlap, the B-node identifier is going to be renamed. I think that does not affect the Wikia use case or use cases like Wikia's, meaning that in the vast majority of cases, you don't have to care. You don't have to be concerned that the B-node is going to be renamed unless you're using something like colon, you know, JSON LD, PG gen or something like that. And if the B-node identifier starts with PG gen or whatever, you should not be depending on that automatically generated identifier anyway. So that allows us to continue to keep this streaming based way of generating B-node identifiers, or rather it allows us to not have to scan the document and push this off into a corner case, where scanning the document basically prevents us from being able to do any kind of streaming based mechanism. So it's a compromise between the two to make sure that we don't just destroy the ability to do the streaming-based mechanism. Marcus, you're on the queue.
Is that kind of the final code of Wikia, or is that gonna change in the future?
It's good, like I said, where the plan is to use URIs, but the Wikia works on a Scrum process with 2-week Scrum cycles, and there are sort of punch list items they get to. One of them, which is coming down the road, is the use of article IDs for identifying objects, but that's down the road. So hopefully we'll get there, probably get there in January.
So what about...
We have a system that is... It's released, at least in demo phase, for this what's called a game guide, and it happens to use B-node identifiers because we hadn't yet reached that milestone.
Yeah. So what about if you just don't relabel blank nodes in the JSON-LD processor you're using for that demo, and then afterwards you update the processor in lockstep with the Wikia code?
Well, I think that's in fact what I would need to do is to add a flag which basically inhibits the B-node renaming things. But if there's a solution that allows us to not have to do B-node renaming during expansion, I think given where we are in the stage of the game, I think that's... that would be preferred to one in which we do need to do renaming.
Just a quick question. Are you using property generators?
No, we're not.
Because we had that discussion that we might add a flag to disable property generators. So we could use that flag to disable blank node relabeling as well.
Well, I don't see how this... If we say that the only time that blank nodes are renamed is if you're using property generators, I don't think that it applies to the Wikia use case at all. Then there's no danger. So the Wikia use case.
Yeah.
Let's assume that, you know, Wikia doesn't change their IDs. The proposal where the only time that there's a risk of blank nodes being renamed is in the property generator use case. I think that's perfectly reasonable.
Well, what happens
That's
if I'm scanning?
Reasonable thing.
What if I'm expanding a document, and not till the very end of the document do I find a property generator term?
If you set that flag that we discussed about before, you wouldn't expand property generators at all. So they're just ignored.
You need to do a flag. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like the whole flag for property generators thing.
We introduced that for denial of service attacks or those kind of things because they grow the document dramatically. I mean, we that's just an idea. We don't have to put that in the spec, but I will for sure put it in my processor at least. Mm-hmm. It's just that could solve Vicky's problem in the short.
That's clearly the way that we would solve the problem, and we don't have to specify something like that.
Yeah.
That can always be done with a processor-specific flag. But I, the reason I brought it up is I thought it was a really big change to make and that we hadn't discussed that in the group. And I do feel that if there is a way to avoid it, that would be a better way to go.
And I agree. I feel like we should try and avoid that. And it seems like we have at least one way that we could avoid doing that. Marcus, what are your thoughts on this? Would you rather try and avoid the renaming of all vnodes in the document if it's possible?
I'm not so sure about it because, well, blank nodes are kind of a tricky thing because they look like identifiers, but in fact they are not really identifiers and they just have document local scope, so you shouldn't reference them externally. And if we relabel all blank nodes, developers will not do that. If we don't do that, they will, of course, use them externally.
Right.
Well, same could be true, said with Turtle and RDFA, but it is common for developers to do that.
That's true, but I think we are addressing a different kind of developer with JSON-LD.
I think the general point that we want to make it very difficult for people to reuse blank node identifiers across two different documents is, I think it's a solid point. But I think that there are people that disagree with that, meaning they feel that people should be able to, meaning they feel that the data shouldn't change out from under the developer.
Well, I mean, the data doesn't change. It's just the blank node identifier that changes, and that
which those developers define as part of the data, right?
Yeah.
So while you and I agree that the blank node identifier is not a part of the data, there are other people that disagree and say that it is part of the data.
Yeah, and by relabeling it, it would be trivial to show them that it's not part of the data. Otherwise, it's, I think, very, very difficult to explain that
that makes a good point.
Okay, so, Greg, does that change your position on relabeling all the blank nodes, or?
I wouldn't say no. I think they're two different issues. And I think part of it is just a concern about making such a big change to a core algorithm.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, we're before last call, so we can make those types of changes if we deem them good changes to make. I agree that it's a large change, but I don't think that should stop us from making the change. I think it's a large change in the way that the algorithms work. I don't think it's, you know, a difficult thing to implement.
Well, I don't think the algorithm it's specified actually, unless you rewrote it to do this, Marcus, I don't think it has as part of the expansion process renaming vnodes. So I think there's some editorial work to do that. I mean, I've been trying to. One of the things that's kept me from being able to do a lot of the updates to the algorithms myself is the need to try to keep my processor up to date. And actually, there's the main thing that's in my way right now is not having fully specified how IRI compaction or term selection works. But yeah, I think we've allowed a lot of time to go since we've made resolutions and we've had spec updated. I'm not sure, Mono, could you, where are Digital Bazaar's implementations with regard to the current spec at this point? Are you tracking?
No, we were tracking as of like a month ago. We were up to date with the spec, but we both, Dave Longley and I, need to sit down. Basically what's going to happen is Marcus is going to make his updates to the algorithm. that Dave Longley and I are going to go through and review to make sure that that matches what we believe the resolutions were in the group, and then we're going to make one final pass over our implementations to bring them in line with what the spec says. Hopefully at that point we will have enough coverage, enough eyes on the problem, enough implementations to agree that those are the final algorithms. So we were up to date as of a month ago, I think, meaning that Dave Longley went through all of the resolutions we had made and modified the processor to match. So I think this requires a little more discussion than we have time for on the telecon today.
I think we could probably get a straw poll anyway on renaming, pervasive renaming of vNode identifiers during expansion.
Well, but you, you disagree.
Well, I'm probably a zero on it.
Okay.
Because I'm of two minds. But the main thing was, I think we needed to talk about it as a group, since it is certainly a big enough change that I think requires some direction from the group rather than something that's just an unilateral editorial change.
Okay. So the proposal then would be to rename all blank node identifiers when doing expansion. Is that effectively what the resolution is?
Yeah, I believe
so. Sorry, the proposal? Okay. I asked Dave Longley very quickly, and he said we should give it a shot and try it out and see how it comes out.
Okay, then I'd say we just resolve it because there's really no negatives.
Okay. Okay. All right. So we'll do that. And I guess there's no reason to create an issue out of this unless we find something horrible as a result of updating the algorithm. Let's do that.
I put the resolution under issue 160 because that's where I asked initially about that.
Okay, good.
So the property generator issue.
Okay, good. All right, so that is resolved. And we can get into the agenda. Anything else on this issue before we move forward? All right, next topic up is issue 203, validating IRI and language tags. Marcus, would you mind going over this issue?
Well, it's basically... The question is basically whether we validate language tags if they are valid according, BCP 47, and whether we validate IRIs. So, well, there could be invalid characters, or there could be, well, the scheme missing, so it's not an absolute IRI after expansion, or things like that. Currently, we say that we just say it must be. In some places we said it must be a valid IRI. In other places we didn't say anything specific. And I think specifically about language tags, there was some feedback from, I think, Richard, who said that, well, language tags have to be normalized to lowercase and they have to be validated, I think. So the question is whether we include that directly into the algorithms, and then we probably have to specify how we validate them, or whether we just assume that they are valid and we treat them as valid, and it's up to the application then to validate them before they get used.
Greg, you're on the
So BCP validation, if you look at Turtle includes sort of a simplistic version of BCP in the definition of the language tag. But if you look at BCP 47 itself, it's actually much more complex than that. And I did a quick scan for libraries that Ruby libraries that purport to do that, and really couldn't find anything. Most use that we have is it's two or three characters followed by a dash followed by some number of non-dash characters. But legally, you could include any number of dash segments, and there are some cases in which those then need to be numeric or can only be alpha. Certainly should only be from the ASCII character set. It's complicated, and I don't think it really it's sort of like we're conflating concerns too much, perhaps, to try to do that. It's not required. Normalization does not require validation. So I would be reluctant to put in any hard requirements on validating BCP. Same with URIs. Libraries I use can detect simple problems with URIs, but again, there's a lot of complexity in URIs, and trying to go through and pervasively check for everything is just not something that I think belongs in a core algorithm. It should be done. If it's done in a different place, then there's libraries that implement that. That's one thing. And if a processor can provide better, I think Francois made the point about the difference between a validator and a processor, is that a validator might want to look for these things and be able to report on them, but it's not the concern of a processor.
Basically what Greg said. I don't think we need to do validation for a JSON-LD processor. I do think we should normalize the BCP47 strings to lowercase, but I think we've already had that resolution. We've already made that resolution, or it's in the spec already, so there would be no change to that. So I guess the proposal currently is that a JSON-LD processor is not required to validate IRIs or BCP47 language strings. Is there anyone that disagrees with that?
So do we say it doesn't, it's unspecified, or do we say it doesn't do any validation? Or
we
it
say
must
not
do a validation?
We don't want to say should not or must not, because that's up to the implementer. If the implementer wants to do certain types of validation, that's up to them. So I think all we should probably say is it's not required to validate IRIs or BCP47 language strings. If someone decides to do that, then I think that's up to them.
So do we want to use may? Or do we want to use should? Probably not should.
Or do we just say nothing about it?
Perhaps we say nothing about it.
We don't say anything, we have the discussion.
Well, we don't do anything in RDFA, I don't believe.
Yeah. It's always strange when you decide not to add something to a spec and you have a discussion about it, because you want to kind of signal to people that you did have the discussion at some point without them having to go through the minutes. Saying something like, you know, a JSON-LD processor is not required to validate IRIs or BCP47 language strings, saying that in the spec at least signals to people that we did have the discussion and we decided that it's not a requirement. Versus letting people kind of wonder if that you know is true, or if they should be doing that or not. Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Could we say something to the effect on that? I don't know. I had a sentence in my mind a second ago. It was about, well, saying something about that it's not users or not implementers, but users of processor might not expect that all processors are fully validating processors, meaning that invalid input data might lead to different results depending on the level of validation that is performed by this processor. So we say what the rules are for the language tags and what is done, which is normalization, but we don't say what happens in the edge cases with strange input data, other than that depends on the level of validation performed by the specific tool used. It's a sort of a warning that all the input data might not lead to the results that you expect, which is pretty nasty, of course, but in reality, this will happen. I mean, it happens for almost any kind of specification which includes references to just basic URLs.
Another approach that we could try is to say that processors may issue warnings for data that is for IRIs or BCP 47 language strings that are not valid, but the processor must not modify the data in any way to correct it. So that way, all of the processors have the same, they do the same thing, but they can get warnings. But the user would be, the person using the processor would get warnings to say that the input is malformed in some way.
I think that sounds pretty good. Does not modify other than attempting to normalize, which we specified that they must do, right?
Right. Greg, Marcus, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I would prefer to not do any validation because that's very complex, I would say.
Right. I don't think any one of us are arguing that we should do validation. Right.
Then probably we should not include any language about it in the algorithms, but state that somewhere in the beginning, the introduction or somewhere, that no validation is done. And, well, we already state that the algorithms are just specified for well-formed, I think, well-formed documents. So probably that's even enough if we say no validation of language text or IRIs is performed by a processor.
Yeah, I don't know if we need to say go that far. We do say that they, to be valid, these must be valid BCP and URIs.
Yeah.
I don't know if we. I think we need to be sure that we are not relying upon a processor to throw an error if an invalid URI is found. And it should tolerate something which does throw an error if an invalid URI or BCP is found. But I don't really know. I'd say we should see what has been done in other similar specifications and follow that lead. I don't think anything is said either in RDFA, Turtle, or RDFXML in that regard. So I just don't know that we need to break new ground there.
I just typed something into the IRC channel as a maybe a proposal.
Except that we don't perform normalization on IRIs. I would be fine with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do we do for our what do we do for IRIs? Yeah.
Nothing.
Okay. Well, we normalize BCP 47 language strings, right?
Well, we should be careful what we mean by normalizing. I mean, we convert to lowercase.
Let's only convert to lowercase. Convert BCP 47 language strings to lowercase.
Well, we can just drop that part of the sentence, I think.
Because we already do it, or we already have a resolution, or it's already in the spec.
Yeah.
Okay, so JSON-LD processors may issue validation warnings for malformed IRIs and BCP 47 language strings, but they must not attempt to correct validation errors.
Yeah.
Does that sound good? And Nicholas, I don't know if you're plus one, minus one on this. Okay. All right, so that's the resolution for now. Next topic is issue... Let's try and do something that's a bit easier. I'm going to jump to agenda item 5, try and get as many resolutions as possible today. Do we want to add a flattened method to the JSON-LD API? I think we have support for doing that. Does anyone disagree that we should not? Does anyone disagree about adding a flattened method to the JSON-LD API?
So it's the same thing as... So... Is it the same thing as expand with the compact flag, or compact with, or flat with a flattened flag, or compact with a flattened flag?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was assuming it would be compact with flattened flag.
Yeah, which is, I believe, what it used to be before, and I still have such an endpoint myself. But I do sort of wonder why not just compact with a flattened flag?
We're trying to signal to developers that there's an easy way of flattening their data.
I see.
I don't think the argument is fairly weak.
I think that's a reasonable argument, actually.
Right.
Yeah, it makes it more of a first class concept.
People are guaranteed not to, or we hope that people won't miss the fact that you can do that, so that they can just iterate over, you know, all the data. Marcus, you're on the queue.
If we are going to add that method, I would also like to drop those flags for expansion and compaction, because they're redundant, and all those flags are just complicating the API, I think.
So
and
the
other thing, sorry, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
And the other thing I wanted to ask is whether we should change flattening slightly to, so that by default it includes also all named graphs, because currently it just returns, I think, the default graph. So currently we add the flag, and you can set it to add default, and then it returns the default graph, or add merge, I think, then it's the union graph, or an IRI of a name graph. I think we could simplify that, or drop that behavior and just return all name graphs as well.
side.
So there are two questions there. The first, at least my thoughts on the first question was, do we want to remove the flattened flag? I guess if we wanted to return something that's expanded form but it's flattened, then what we would have to do is, if the person wanted an expanded form, they would have to flatten it first, and then they would have to expand. Is that correct?
You could just pass an empty context to flatten, so it wouldn't be compacted or null as a context.
So it would be expanded in that case. So that's kind of a little trick that you could do. Yeah, I guess that would work. I'm always wary of API tricks like that, though, that are not very explicit. Like, it seems to me expand with a flattened flag is more clear than a flatten with an empty context.
Well, I mean, you can see it from two sides. Flattening is quite different from expansion. So a flag there is, I think, more magic than having flattened with an empty context, which says you basically don't compact IRIs because you have nothing to compact it to.
Okay. So in that case, I think I'd be okay with removing the flag. I was afraid that we had some use case where you needed the flattened flag on compact or on expand. And I guess what we're saying is that that's no longer, we don't have such a use case. Okay. So the answer to the second question, Marcus, is I'm guessing that we don't want to be lossy with the flattened mechanism, so that we'd want to put all named graphs in there.
Okay.
Because otherwise we'd have a lossy algorithm, and that's typically we've argued against doing that.
Yeah, that's what I want as well, yeah.
Okay. All right, so the proposal is add a flat method to the JSON-LD API, which is effectively compact with the flattened flag, set to true. Well, actually, let's just API which returns all data in compact form in flattened compact form. Okay, so we add a flattened method to the JSON-LD API, which returns all data in flattened compact form. Remove the flatten flag from the expand and compact method calls, from the expand and compact methods. Ensure that the flatten method preserves data in named graphs. Okay, so that's the proposal.
So the signature of that method would be the thing I posted just above your proposal, right?
I think so. I'm not as concerned about the signature because we can change it in the future, but that looks right to me. That's a good point.
I added an introduction to flattening to the APIs back. I think that should make it quite clear. But
if they read the spec.
Yeah, well, that's always the thing. But
well, I think even in the library, the people that generate libraries for this stuff will have a simple one sentence description for it. That will hopefully be. I don't feel like it's a very complex concept. So I think the API documentation for any library will have a decent summary of what Flat does.
Yeah. But in general, I'm haven't had time to really digest the sense we seem to get from people not understanding JSON-LD at all when we say to them that, well, you can use JSON-LD to digest RDFA data and use it in an easy manner, and I need to ponder that over the holidays to see if the design of the API really is simple to use or if it has to be hidden behind something else when we use it in the combination with the RDFA too.
All right. Okay, so I think that's we have a resolution. We can change it if it turns out that it generates confusion or there's a corner case that we forgot about. Okay, next up is issue 206, clarify that the algorithms operate on a copy of the input, just rearranging the agenda so that we can try and get as many resolutions down as possible. I think this is a fairly easy decision. We want to clarify that that the implementer should not modify the data structure in place, that the modification should happen on a copy of the input. Does anyone disagree with that?
So basically that's about the API. It's not about the algorithms, is it?
Correct. Yeah, I think we just JavaScript's passed by reference, and so we want to make sure that the input document isn't modified at all when doing compact and expand. And what they get back in the callback, we want to make sure that what they get back in the callback is a new document. It's not the input document that they provided.
Yeah.
Okay, implementers must operate on a copy of the input document when implementing all JSON-LD API methods.
The other way to say that would be that the operating the core algorithms must not affect the underlying data representation.
Could. That's a little more vague, I feel, than being specific, saying that the input document must not be modified.
Well, that's the key is that we don't want. It sort of comes out to something that came up on SWIG IRC yesterday, which I never responded to, but it was someone complaining that JSON-LD was explicitly about a JSON syntax where it really would be useful to be done on something that's more general, for instance, raw JavaScript data structures or BSON. I mean, the fact that it's JSON implies that it is a serialization, that these algorithms work on a serialization, and you're not going to modify the serialization. If we were to say that the algorithms operate upon a sort of a data model, that's when the sense of copying becomes important. And it might actually be worth saying something informatively about the ability of the algorithms to operate over sort of data rather than serialization.
Right. Although, yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I think that is valuable. I'm trying to think of a way to express that.
another good use case is reading in YAML and having just the dictionaries to generate RDF using a JSON-LD context.
Okay, so we're getting a little off topic because the issue is clarify that the algorithms operate on a copy of the input, which I think is fairly straightforward. So I think the proposal should be implementers must operate on a copy of the input document when implementing JSON-LD API methods. So I think that addresses this issue, but I think that the other issue that Greg just brought up is important as well. Does anyone disagree with this proposal, or Greg, can you think of rewording it in a different way?
Well, I think the problem is that it implies that the input is not a JSON document. JSON-LD works on JSON documents, which are serializations, and it's like we don't say in RDFA. If RDFA can be run against a DOM, but it is specified with respect to, actually, is it, maybe it is rough, maybe it is described, it's not, or an info set. I think it allows for various implementations. The tests are all done by providing documents, and it's impossible for any processor to modify those documents.
Right.
It's impossible for a JSON-LD processor to modify an input JSON document. It is not impossible to modify the object representation of the result of parsing a JSON document, or the result of running these algorithms over an in-memory representation, say in JavaScript.
So your issue is the word document there. So if we said implementers must operate on a copy of the input when implementing JSON-LD API methods,
I think it'd be sufficient to say that these algorithms are defined for JSON documents. Implementations may operate on native data representations. And if so, must ensure that they do not, that the operation of the algorithms does not modify those input data representations.
Okay. Go ahead, Marcus.
Sorry, yeah.
It's fine.
The problem is that all the algorithms, they work on a data representation. They don't work on a document, so not on a serialization, and we modify them in place. And the difference between JSON-LD and RDFA, for example, is that JSON-LD has a direct in-memory representation, and that's one of the strengths of JSON. So I think the only thing we must say is that the APIs call the algorithms on copies of the input and not pass, they don't pass the input directly to the algorithms.
Well, are the APIs defined, and I could just look, I guess, but is the input to the algorithm a URI? Is it a...
It can be either the already parsed JSONs, an object or an array of the objects, or a DOM string. So
that's the way my implementation is, but...
Yeah, so basically you are modifying the structure. Or the algorithms are defined to do so. So we must specify that the API calls the algorithms and passes copies of the input instead of directly the input.
But that's very expensive. It's much better to just build a new data structure. Are the algorithms defined to modify the input?
Yeah, every single algorithm.
Well, no, in many cases the algorithms, say, make a copy. For instance, in the expansion for property generators, specifically says make a copy, although prior to that you have made a modification to add an missing identifier. So there are cases in which we say do copies.
It seems very complex. I wouldn't implement it like that at all. Do you have to delete the keys that you've compacted and things like that?
Yeah.
When you're expanding, you create a new structure. Because we're sorting things and the like, right? We have an output object that is the result of expansion.
Why doesn't compaction do that as well? Seems much simpler.
Compaction works on an expanded document, so since you always expand before compacting, you are sort of, because you are making copies when you expand, you are operating on copies when you compact as well.
It seems, well, I haven't done it like that, although it was a while ago that I looked at the specs. But I wouldn't, I mean, I often have expanded data in the input as well, and it just makes sense to create new objects all the way.
Well, so on step 4.2 of expansion, it says initialize an empty JSON object result. Then you process each property, and the result is adding something to result.
Yeah, and I just don't understand why compaction should work to modify anything in place.
Well, but then in the end, in expansion, you set element to result, for example.
Well, but element an element is a variable within the algorithm.
It's
right.
The input. So, element is set to the JSON of the input. And that's how the algorithms have been since the very beginning.
Well, that's different than saying that the result is copied to element. I mean, it passed by a reference. If I imagine that, basically, element is a reference to the structure that I'm working on, and if I replace element with a result, it's not basically doing it's not modifying the thing to which element pointed. I'm trying to think what language that's for which that wouldn't be the case.
Well, if it's not
a reference.
How can you replace it?
Well, it is a reference, though, right? We don't pass... This data is not passed by value. It's passed by reference.
Yeah.
I guess that comes down to what is the web idol model for representing this type of information. I don't think it's possible to. I don't think it's possible to expand or compact something and implement things the way that are said here and have the resulting inputs be modified.
Sorry, can you say that again?
I don't see how I could use any JSON process, a JSON LD algorithm, because they all depend upon expansion. And if you implement expansion the way it's set here, and you pass it the object, if you start with an object, I don't see how the result could possibly modify the object that you passed in.
Okay, I'm hearing two different things at this point. When in the beginning I thought we were saying one thing. I'm hearing saying that we do operate on a copy of the input, and that's what I thought that we were doing. And I'm hearing Nicholas say, "No, that's fairly inefficient. I wouldn't implement it like that." Is that correct?
Yeah, basically, I mean, in JavaScript, would you start off in compaction by doing a deep copy of the entire tree when you effectively just can do that in the algorithm, creating a new compact tree?
It's usually left up to the API to figure out what the best thing to do. But typically, what you try and do, you do not modify. If you're going to return something in a callback, the thing that you're returning is probably not going to be a modified form of the input. It's going to be a completely new object. And yes, it is less efficient from a memory standpoint, but they do that so that there aren't any side effects of calling that method.
You shouldn't write the algorithms to imply that it's okay to have a side effect on the input. I don't see why we have to do that.
I think what we're talking about is ensuring that the algorithms are very clear in that there is no side effect when you make these method calls, right?
Well, it's fine to add some clarification about it, but I can't. When I compact, part of compaction is expansion, and expansion always creates a different output.
Yeah, that's true, but the problem is, as you also raised before, if you find a way to not having to do expansion when it's already in an expanded form in the input, I don't see why the compaction algorithm would be so inefficiently written that it mutates data in place. It doesn't seem like a good design for an algorithm.
Wait, I'm confused. Are you saying that the compaction algorithm right now mutates data in place, or are you saying that ideally the compaction algorithm would mutate data in place?
Well, the compaction algorithm doesn't. I mean, right now it's in 2.3, it says construct output as a new JSON object used for returning the result of compacting element.
Yeah, but then it doesn't mutate, and that's good.
Yeah, so neither expansion nor compaction mutate. They explicitly return essentially new things that are constructed. So it's not a matter of taking the input, making a copy of it, then operating over it. It's the process of going through the input results in new objects.
Exactly. And then it doesn't have to make a copy of anything.
Okay. So it sounds like I agree with what both Nicholas and Greg just said. That's how I thought that these algorithms were meant to work in the beginning. So if we say anything that's different from that, we should correct it.
Yeah.
I think
before it was, for example, that in expansion we said we iterate over all the key value pairs, and we then in the beginning drop that key value pair from element, and then we add it again later. I changed it so that we now initialize a new object, which I called result, and then add to that object the key value pairs, instead of removing them from element and then re-adding them.
Yeah,
so
and
I think,
that's much better.
Yeah,
that's good.
So I think the issue is more or less resolved. We just want to highlight that somehow in the API declaration. That
yes.
The input should never be modified, right?
Yeah.
Correct.
It should be the part of the contract, regardless of if someone follows the implementation or does something else.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's simplify this then. Any input to JSON-LD API methods must not be modified.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so there's that proposal.
All right.
And then I believe that addresses your issue as well, Greg, that you raised in an indirect way, but so that means that people can operate on BSON or YAML, you know, parse trees or whatever.
It already says so in the algorithms. I think it just wasn't necessarily clear. I think the issue is, why are we called JSON LD? when it's not just JSON. It's operating upon other things. But, you know, that sort of gets to be ridiculous. It's clear that it can be done that way. BSON is another matter. The only way to operate on BSON is to transform BSON into JSON, into an object
data
representation.
Model.
But although it would be cool, that someone might consider an extension to deal, for instance, with the native date representations in BSON.
Right. Okay. We are over time for today. We only have two more issues that we should have gotten to, but those are fairly simple ones. No telecons for the next 2 weeks. So the next telecon we'll have will be the second week of January. Okay, that's it for the call. I hope everyone has a fantastic set of holidays and a nice relaxing time. And we'll see you guys in 2013.
Yeah.
Okay.
Same to you.
To you too.
All right.
One of you.
Take care, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.